There's a time and a place for a fillet of fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Ukraine conflict, Russians versus NATO. And I welcome Patrick Tucker, the Defense One technology editor, to introduce us to a topic that Patrick and I have been talking on and off for years. This is robots, not just ordinary robots, killer robots, or in this case, robots shaped to destroy main battle tanks, much in the news as headed to Ukraine. A very good evening to you, Patrick. The success of the Javelin man-launched anti-tank missile early in the Ukraine conflict has led to what I would say is anti-tank envy on the part of the Russian forces. What is it they're up to about the Abrams and Leopard? What are we learning? Good evening to you.
Good evening. So what happened was at the end of last month, Dmitry Rogozin, he's a former head of the Russian space corporation, Roscosmos. He now leads a kind of, it's a consultancy called the Royal Wolves that works with the Russian government, basically finding technology solutions and advancing them to the Russian government. He has said that his company is going to develop a version of their ground reconnaissance robot. It's called the Marker ground reconnaissance robot, outfitted with arms. And he says that key on his mind is framing the robot with footage of various Western tanks, including the Abrams that the U.S. is sending to Ukraine. They'll probably get there at the end of the year. The Leopard tanks that will get there much sooner. And basically, the attempt here is to use lethal ground robots, if he's able to pull this off, to attack Western tanks. And that's going to potentially pose a problem for Western tank makers in the future if he's able to pull it off. And even though this is something that he expressed as though it was absolutely going to happen, and even though Russia has deployed ground robots in lethal settings, both in Syria and to a smaller extent in Ukraine, there's still reasons to be skeptical that they can actually achieve this, a large part because this maker in particularly is heavily reliant on Western microelectronics parts. So the supply side crunch that the U.S. and other allies have put on Russia through sanctions is probably going to affect Rogozin's ability to make anything going forward, as has been shown by some of his previous inventions and things like that. So having said that, he still is very intent on the will. And it's just another kind of bleak milestone in how much of warfare can be sped up and automated. It's not just sort of science fictional. It's now something that is being spoken about in terms of an actual conflict right now.
They're called unmanned ground vehicles, UGVs. What do they look like? Do we have a prototype?
Yes. Well, this one is going to be a version of their Marker ground reconnaissance robot, and you can Google it. It basically looks like it's got tracks. It's got a cylinder in the center that's got your LIDAR, your various sensors, which is how it perceives the environment around it. And you can affix munitions to it. You can affix artillery or machine guns or whatever you want so that it can then fire on things that it's, you know, fall within its perception and have been designated as fire friendly. So it just looks like a little tank robot, basically.
And it is in development. However, part of the development of a robot that kills is the question of, does a human being belong in the decision chain? And Patrick has written about this over the years. Right now, there's a DoD policy that is clarifying or has been clarified. Where are we in this process, Patrick?
Yes, so they feel like this is now clarified. The Defense Department has addressed what was a kind of ambiguity about their longstanding policy on what's called keeping a human in the loop. So that was DoD 3000.09. It's not a very charismatic title for this thing, but it's basically a doctrine. It goes back to 2012. It says that the Defense Department would strongly prefer there to be some sort of human in the loop on lethal autonomy decisions. But that policy also says that, hey, if you get if you really want to take the human out of the loop and you can get some higher ups to sign off on it, then that's a possibility too. So that led a lot of people to kind of wonder, well, what exactly is the U.S. policy on this thing? So now what DOD has done is tried to clarify that with a new version of the policy that basically says, yes, it's true that if you get somebody to sign off on it, you can talk about removing the human from the loop. But here's 80 pages of ethics principles that we have in place that basically spells out under what possible conditions that might happen. So it's not just going to be some sort of like random moment or up to any specific like commander to all of a sudden willy-nilly. You know, kind of go Jack D. Ripper for, you know, the Dr. Strangelove fans out there and make a unilateral decision to create lethal autonomy. And this is something that the Pentagon has gone back and forth on, again, since 2012 for years. But they're making very fast progress now. And actually, just today, Bonnie Jenkins, who is an undersecretary of state at the State Department, is speaking in the Netherlands and advancing a new declaration on the principled use of AI in warfare to try and get really countries around the world to agree to some sense of norms and standards about when you can have lethal autonomy, what it looks like, and does it adhere to written and published principles like the United States Defense Department does. And the hope is to sort of form a contrast between the way the U.S. does this with principles that are clearly spelled out and the way Russia and China do it, which one senior defense official yesterday to me described as a very opaque way of crafting policy around lethal autonomy. You're never exactly sure what you're going to get. So the U.S. is looking to contrast that. And this policy declaration is just another step in that direction to really showcase how they have done a lot of intellectual and legal work to figure out how to incorporate artificial intelligence into warfare. And that's supposed to be very reassuring.
Michael Horowitz is the director of the Emerging Capabilities Policy Office, Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. I follow your reporting here because his remark is, if a non-autonomous weapon system has autonomous capabilities added to it, it makes clear that it would have to go through the review process. Is that what we're now going through? Has that been achieved yet?
Well, yeah. So an autonomous weapon system that we're thinking about here, this doesn't exist yet. This is really for future weapon systems. Okay. But depending on how you define it, in some ways, like the a phalanx shoot system that exists in a lot of ships where it detects incoming fire or missile and spins around and shoots at it before it can take the ship out faster than any human can find the target and fire on it. In some ways, we've actually had autonomous weapon systems like that in that very limited context for decades. But in terms of something that goes out an air platform, a ground platform, something in the air on the ground that finds targets on its own, that you know, makes decisions without any human intervention, this is something that doesn't exist yet. And so what the Defense Department is trying to do is really get everyone to understand under what contexts that might be a thing that happens and why, so that no one is confused about whether or not or how the Defense Department is going to do something. And key to that, as you point out, is that anything that exists right now that could maybe be made a little bit more capable or lethal by sticking some, an autonomy software program on it or sticking a big, you know, M4 machine gun on it or what have you, sort of like what Reznikov is trying to do with this Russian marker robot, that you can't just do unilaterally. That has to be something that is a department-wide decision. And also that has to go through a pretty stringent and now spelled out review process.
This is a subset of what AI means to military organizations around the world. Is that correct? We're glimpsing through a small window here. There's a bigger story going on about how AI helps or hinders. This is the part that fascinates me is when we wander into Philip K. Dick territory, which is where we are right now. What I'm learning from you is that they're developing guidelines, but one doesn't exist right now because we haven't got a killer robot. Or do we? Do we know of such a thing, an autonomous vehicle that kills?
Well, so the Russian weapons makers, particularly Kalashnikov, have said that they've made systems that can autonomously target and fire on things. Actually, producing something that does that wouldn't be technically very difficult. You just have enormous safety issues if you decide to put that into practice. In terms of what the U.S. has, the closest thing would be this ship defense system that basically shoots at missiles that are coming at the boat.
Right.
But that's the closest that we've had. And beyond that, for years, the Defense Department really wanted to emphasize that they want a human in the loop. And now they're beginning to talk more and more about the context in which that human can be out of the loop and reassure you that they're being responsible about it. And that just goes to show that they're thinking a lot more about ways in which AI can begin to change warfare, make systems a lot more capable, a lot more lethal. And that means they have to broaden their comfort zone on how much autonomy they actually want to put on these things.
Patrick Tucker is the technology editor for Defense One. We're talking about robots. We're going to move now to communication systems, one in particular that I use routinely, Starlink. Starlink on the battlefield? Question mark. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'll be here to hear what's on your mind.
Kids want to share what's going on in their lives with the adults around them. Parents, grandparents, teachers, coaches, and more. They want to know you're listening, and they want to listen to you. They want your input and guidance, early and often, on all kinds of topics. When it comes to a serious subject like underage drinking, they want to know your expectations, as well as how and why, as a young person, they should avoid alcohol. How you talk about it will change as your child grows, but the important thing is to talk about it. Not just once for an hour when you think the time is right, but in 60 one-minute conversations and more that are part of your everyday talks. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
When you need me, I'll be by your side.
We all make choices. When it comes to alcohol, kids make choices whether to drink or not.
Bye, Dad.
Bye-bye.
Remember, I'm going to Alex's party tonight and sleeping over.
Hey, Em, have a seat for a second. Remind me about that party again.
Alex is just...
And adults make choices whether to talk about it. That's true of parents and every other trusted adult in a kid's life. Kids want to know our expectations when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. They want guidance and honest answers to their questions. And it makes a difference when the message is consistent and part of everyday conversations. So talk with your kids and help lead them on a positive path. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Having MG can make cooking difficult, but over the years, I've found some really helpful tools and tips that I'm excited to share. Hi, I'm Alicia. I think cooking should always be fun, creative, and of course, delicious. These black bean burgers are hearty, full of flavor, and MG friendly. You're gonna love them.
Check out Alicia's Black Bean Burger cooking video and other recipes full of tips and tricks for managing common MG symptoms while cooking only at mg-united.com.
Ready? Let's cook.
Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.